focus on at home?
I wrote about that in an op-ed last week with a colleague in La Jornada, in which we argued that the loss at the Fifth District Court puts the Trump administration in a bind. They want to deport 650,000 Venezuelans. They use the Enemy Aliens Act as the pretext. The court rejected it. So now he has the choice of going back to the Fifth District or the Supreme Court. It's a case of wag the dog. If we all remember the movie in 1997, where you create a war, you create a conflict in order to distract attention from what's happening in the U.S. So there is a national component, a U.S. component to this conflict. There's a Venezuelan component, but they dovetail nicely around the issue of the deportations. As Trump seeks to distract attention from the Epstein case and from the economy and from other issues that are occurring in the U.S.
Finally, Vice President J.D. Vance dismissed accusations that the first attack on the boat that killed 11 people may have been a war crime if civilians were on board. Vance wrote on X, "I don't give a," rhymes with hit, "what you think," he said. "I don't give a what you call it," using the expletive. He was responding to Republican Senator Rand Paul criticizing Vance's comments, saying what a despicable and thoughtless sentiment it is to glorify killing someone without a trial. You have 10 seconds, Professor Tinker Salas.
Again, the U.S. puts itself above the law, above international law, and places itself as a judge, jury, and executioner without ever providing any evidence.
Professor Miguel Tinker Salas, Emeritus Professor of History at Pomona College in Claremont, California. You can go to our website for our interview with him in Spanish at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held. KBOO's Loud and Proud. Become a member during our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive taking place now through September 20th. Your contribution goes towards grassroots, independent, radically made community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give and help us reach our $45,000 goal. Thank you. Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service helping those who are feeling sad, struggling with alcohol or drug use, or just need someone to talk to. Trained counselors are able to listen and provide support 24/7. Confidential support is available by text or phone call to 988. More information is available at 988oregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, Oregon layoff rates match those seen in the Great Recession. Washington residents are entitled to sick pay if they must attend immigration proceedings. And Providence hospitals will close their pediatric ICU in Portland. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 16, 2025. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Eric Leuschner. Layoffs in Oregon are approaching the same level as the Great Recession in 2008. Since the beginning of 2024, at least 11,000 Oregonians have been laid off, according to a count of layoffs reported to the state. The Oregonian reports that the monthly rate of layoffs is now higher than it was in 2008 and 2009. Then, Oregon had an 11% unemployment rate, and it was difficult for laid-off workers to find new work. Today, 5% of Oregonians are unemployed, a moderate level. A third of layoffs came from Intel, the largest corporate employer in Oregon. Other mass layoffs came from companies like Wells Fargo, Nike, OHSU, Albertsons, and Fred Meyer. The layoff rate is high, but not nearly as high as the record layoff workers endured at the beginning of the COVID pandemic in 2020. Workers in Washington can now use their paid sick and safe leave time to attend immigration-related proceedings thanks to a new law that came into effect. The law expands previous legislation and applies to workers, their families, and anyone who depends on them for support. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
Washington lawmakers have expanded the state's paid sick and safe leave time to allow for workers to use earned paid leave to attend immigration-related proceedings. The new law, which came into effect this summer, allows people to attend immigration hearings or meet with legal counsel for themselves or their family members without risking their income or employment. Hannah Sabio-Howell is with Working Washington and the Fair Work Center, groups that organize low-wage workers such as farm workers and restaurant staff, many of which are part of immigrant communities.
Expanding our paid sick and safe time law is an important way of keeping our communities stable at a time when particularly undocumented workers and families are needing to defend their livelihoods and their well-being.
Sabio Howell notes this policy does not expand the amount of paid sick and safe hours that are available to workers, but rather the ways in which people can use them. The new law also expands the definition of family, Sabio Howell explains, to include anyone depending on the worker for care, whether or not they are related or live together. As a result, workers can now use sick and safe leave to assist people outside their immediate family with immigration proceedings. She says this change will benefit the state's economy.
Workplaces stay whole, families stay whole when more workers and more of the members of their communities can rely on the care they need.
Joe Mizrahi is with UFCW Local 3000, a union representing 50,000 members working in grocery, retail, healthcare, and other industries that backed the new law. He says the next step is to make sure employers are following it.
We would always love to see stronger funding for enforcement on a statewide level, or to see laws like this pass in cities, which can seem duplicative, but actually then allows for city enforcement as well.
Mizrahi adds it may seem like a small change, but the new law will have a meaningful impact on immigrant communities. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
The Providence Hospital System will close its pediatric intensive care unit at St. Vincent Medical Center, citing financial problems. The pediatric ICU has been around since 2013 and has 3 beds for children needing intense care. Providence has made a number of service cuts this year to stem a $100 million operating loss in Oregon. Pediatric services are often the first programs to be cut because children make up a smaller part of the population and need the hospital less often. It's a decision the Oregon Nurses Association is calling misguided and abhorrent. The Union for the Nurses said in a statement that it's particularly bad timing going into cold, flu, and RSV season. They also point out that while the pediatric ICU operated at a loss last year, Providence paid executives a combined $194 million in 2023. They wrote, quote, "It proves, yet again, that the healthcare system is more concerned about its profits than the health of the community it purports to serve." Providence also announced it will close its family birth center in Seaside in October. With the closure at St. Vincent's, children needing intensive care in the Portland area will instead be referred to Legacy Randall Children's Hospital, or OHSU. About 1,000 people gathered in Eugene at a weekend candlelight vigil honoring white nationalist conservative activist Charlie Kirk, who was shot last week in Utah. The event in Eugene was among the largest public gatherings of conservatives in the city in recent years. Kirk was the co-founder of Turning Point USA and an ally of Donald Trump, who said Kirk was like a son to him. The crowd observed a moment of silence outside the University of Oregon's Hayward Field. Flags there were hung at half staff in Kirk's honor under a recent order from Governor Tina Kotek. Attendees also lifted an enormous American flag into the air. Organizers claimed it was the same one that hung off the side of the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Kirk, 31, was shot while speaking at a college campus last Wednesday. A suspect in the case has been charged with aggravated murder. Conservatives have blamed the, quote, radical left for the shooting, though little evidence has emerged regarding the suspect's true beliefs or motives. Kirk's critics have pointed out that Republicans and many in the mainstream media have attempted to whitewash his extreme homophobic, transphobic, racist, and sexist beliefs. But at Saturday's event, Portland area right-wing activist and Patriot Prayer founder Joey Gibbon told the crowd he was proud of Kirk, describing him as, quote, fearless. Gibson urged the crowd to forgive those who have celebrated the death of Kirk online. Gibson said, quote, it's hard when people keep coming after us. They keep killing us. They keep putting us in prison, constantly lying about us, taking away our jobs. I get it. But the most important thing is that we continue to just love and stand tall and keep your faith in Jesus, end quote. Organizer Chris Tuff called on the attendees to rebuild the Patriot movement in the United States. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker and President Trump debate political violence, and advocates say administration orders on cashless bail punish the poor. With those stories and more, it's Zimon Perez with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This is a moment when Americans must come together and say clearly that threats and political violence are not the answer.
Illinois Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker is calling for peace following the assassination of right-wing influencer Charlie Kirk. The governor and potential 2028 contender says all political violence is wrong, but made a point to call out President Donald Trump's response to the assassination as divisive and corrosive. The right-wing Illinois Freedom Caucus filed articles of impeachment against Pritzker, alleging he's inciting violence. According to the New York Times, the White House and cabinet officials now want to use anti-terrorist powers against an alleged left-wing network. The administration is also pressing for punishment of anyone who posts favorable comments about Kirk's killing. A previous Ohio congressional map failed to get the bipartisan approval required by a court order. That means the Buckeye State is one of half a dozen now dealing with an unusual and highly partisan round of mid-decade redistricting. Republicans currently hold two-thirds of Ohio's 15 seats in Congress, but only get about 55% of votes statewide. Bria Bennett with the Ohio Organizing Collaborative says a fair map would have closer to an 8-7 balance.
Ohioans are sick of being cheated out of fair representation. We're calling for transparency. We're calling for community integrity. We're calling for balanced representation. We just want our politicians to do what's right.
Texas has already changed its boundaries, while Californians will vote on a ballot measure this November. Indiana, Missouri, Florida, Maryland, and New York are all debating redistricting. Civil rights groups warn a Trump executive order rolling back cashless bail will punish poverty without making the public safer. The order can't dictate policy by state and local courts, but does threaten to withhold funds from communities that end cashless bail. But comparing more than 20 cities that reformed bail with a dozen that didn't show no impact on the crime rate. Sarah Rose, with the ACLU of Pennsylvania, says in spite of the rhetoric, the executive order won't do a thing for public safety.
Cash bail is to ensure that people show up for court proceedings. And we know there's been a lot of studies done. There's a lot of other more effective ways to make sure that people show up for their court proceedings than to assign cash bail.
Nearly two-thirds of the 500,000 people in jail are awaiting trial, most because they can't make bail. Today is National Voter Registration Day. According to the census, less than 75% of eligible U.S. voters are registered, meaning nearly 50 million people in the United States who have the right to vote can't. Joanne Antoine is with Common Cause Maryland.
A decision not to is almost like you're making a decision already. You are letting the individual who maybe is not in line with your interests, you're giving them a greater opportunity to be elected.
Trump announced on Truth Social that the U.S. conducted a second strike on an alleged Venezuelan drug vessel in international waters. After the first strike, lawmakers from both parties questioned the legality. I'm Zimon Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hey, how are you? Well, they're too good.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $45,000 by September 20th. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on an exhibit at the Multnomah Art Center opening this week, taking a look back at the works of the Portland Zine Symposium. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 59 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be warm and sunny with a high of 80 degrees. Today in history, in 1620, pilgrims set sail for Virginia from Plymouth, England, in the Mayflower. The quote of the day is from American actor Robert Redford, who died today at the age of 89. He said, quote, "Sound and accurate journalism defends our democracy. It's one of the most effective weapons at our disposal to contain the power hungry. I've always said that All the President's Men is a violent movie. No shots are fired, but words are used as if they were weapons." Earlier this year, the Department of Governmental Efficiency targeted a number of Bureau of Indian Affairs offices for closure, but they're still standing for now. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Bureau of Indian Affairs offices in Wisconsin and Minnesota remain open after the Department of Government Efficiency targeted them for termination. As Danielle Kading reports, the initiative, formerly led by billionaire Elon Musk, had proposed canceling leases for several offices earlier this year.
The cancellations affected offices in Ashland and Shawnee in Wisconsin and Bemidji in Minnesota. Wisconsin tribes say the Bureau of Indian Affairs office in Ashland is a critical regional hub that processes land trust applications and provides education assistance and law enforcement support. Robert Blanchard is chair of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. He says closing the office would have been a hardship for the tribe.
We would have probably had to go maybe Minneapolis or some other place further away from us to get services.
Bill Broidrick represents the owner of the Ashland office. He says Wisconsin tribes adopted a resolution in opposition to its closure.
On that basis, the decision was made by the Bureau of Indian Affairs to keep the office open.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs says all three offices remain open. The agency says it's working to ensure adequate space continues to be available to support delivery of services to tribes. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
While summer is winding down, powwow season is now a year-long observation thanks to venues held indoors or in warmer climes like the Southwest. But you can still get a chilly reception if you don't mind your manners. Buffalo's Fire recently talked to several natives at the 55th United Tribes Technical College powwow and asked them what their number one rule for good etiquette was.
One of the main things I'd say not to do at a powwow is put your chairs down where the drums are supposed to be. Gotta think about all the singers, and singers have wives and they got kids and whatnot. A lot of folks try to fight for space and yet they don't even sit there the whole weekend.
My rule is to pick up after yourself wherever you're sitting. Make sure the trash gets in the garbage can.
People should know is not to take pictures of you without your permission. Always ask where you're from, your name, what tribe you're from, where you're from, if it's okay if take pictures of them.
Don't block the elders. Let them through if they're getting to their chairs. Don't stand in front of them when they're trying to watch the powwow.
Well, no picture taking unless you're buying, because they usually send it back overseas and they copy our work and then they send it back over here. They sell it for cheap. Like they say it's native made, but they're not native made.
My rule is to be good and help look out for the vendors. A lot of the times that they sit here and they have to spend a lot of their day, they don't get the chance to get up, to go get drinks, to go get food. So outside of just being kind and smiling and, you know, see if you have the opportunity to offer a hand and help them out, you know, do so. Help them, you know, see if they had water, see if they got something to eat and stuff like that. Just be good to them.
That was Dion Crazy Bull, Gabby Rave, Easton Wolf, Richard Gillette, Leroy Henry, and Gia MacArthur, all natives sharing their powwows, do's, and don'ts as part of Buffalo's Fire's coverage of the UTTC International Powwow held earlier this month. And on this day in 1893, following a pistol shot, more than 100,000 settlers raced onto the Cherokee Strip of Oklahoma, land once inhabited by Native Americans. It was the largest land run in history for territory once considered too arid for farmers and relegated to displaced Native people. But settlers pressured President Benjamin Harrison to open up the area to non-Natives, who hurried to stake their claim. September 16th is also Trail of Tears Commemoration Day for the thousands of Cherokees forced to leave their homes during President Andrew Jackson's term. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
Farmers are one of the jobs with the highest rate of suicide. One group is attempting to help by teaching mental health professionals to think like a farmer. Land Logic, an innovative new therapy, uses farmers' own land to help reduce their risk of suicide. Eric Galatas has the details.
Farmers face numerous stressors, from economic troubles to unpredictable weather, and they have one of the highest rates of suicide of any occupation. Behavioral health care providers are now being taught a new method to identify depression, anxiety, and other issues among farmers. LandLogic co-developer Kayla Anderson, who grew up on a farm, says farmers don't typically talk about their emotions, but asking them to draw a map of their land and explain what happens where helps start a conversation that can reveal underlying emotional struggles.
Because we believe that licensed behavioral health providers that may be wanting to serve this population just need that one little piece to connect, and then their knowledge and expertise and their work with the farmer can take off from there.
A cattle feedlot, for instance, might be a source of intense stress when there isn't enough money to feed the cattle, or a reliable field of alfalfa could be a place where a farmer finds solace. Anderson notes farmers are problem solvers by necessity. The therapists LandLogic trains learn how to identify mental health issues through associations with everyday agricultural tools, like a pair of favorite work gloves. They then help farmers learn to overcome challenges on their own as they spend time out on their land. Therapists are also taught how to identify 10 common negative thinking patterns that Anderson calls barbed wire thinking, including toxic grit when farmers continue to toil away even when it's causing them harm.
The get her done, pull yourselves up by the bootstraps, there's no time for emotions. That piece is part of what has kept farmers farming and is a very good skill set until the moment it's not.
Farmers are good at their jobs because they're deeply attached to their land and are at risk when that role is threatened. Anderson says the moment they see how this agricultural imperative impacts their behavior is a launching point. Once they can name it, they can own it and work it out.
Naming it and claiming it is one of the most important parts of land logic for the farmer because it brings so much light and you can see it. You can see it visibly when they have that moment of clarity, and that's really powerful and awesome to watch.
This story was produced with original reporting from Dean Coopers for the Food and Environmental Reporting Network. This is Eric Galatas for the Colorado News Connection.
Eating more plant-based meals can be an important strategy to combat climate change. One nonprofit is working with hospitals to make vegetarian meals the default. Dr. Anthony Lysowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lysowitz, and this is Climate Connections. There are many vegetarian sources of protein, and Alana Braverman wants to help more people enjoy them.
Tempeh, tofu, seitan, fava beans, black-eyed peas, kidney beans. I could go on and on.
Braverman co-founded Greener by Default, a nonprofit that encourages hospitals and other institutions to offer plant-based proteins by default instead of by special request.
All to help make plant-based the easy choice and normalize that option.
For example, her group helps Sodexo, a food service provider, begin to offer 2 vegetarian chef specials daily at 11 New York City hospitals.
Both of those specials were offered to the patients. If they said no to both of those options, then they were offered a different choice.
The nonprofit helped rename the dishes to highlight their flavors, and the chef led tastings for hospital staff so they could give genuine recommendations.
And this resulted in about 50% of patients eating those plant-based meals.
Eating more plant-rich foods is linked to a lower risk of heart disease and diabetes. And it helps the climate, because growing vegetables causes less carbon pollution than producing meat products. So making vegetarian meals the default menu option can benefit the health of people and the climate. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Now we go to Global Citizen Commentary from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. He says Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is the preeminent political survivor. He has used the war with Hamas to evade all manner of crises and to keep the Americans at bay. No peace plan short of Hamas surrender will satisfy him. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. One thing about Benjamin Netanyahu, he's no taco. That's Trump always chickens out. Through all Israel's travails since the October 2023 Hamas attack, Netanyahu has never wavered in his strategy. Destroy Hamas as a military and political force, and emerge with his leadership of Israel intact, freeing the hostages, concluding a ceasefire, reaching a settlement, normalizing relations with neighboring states. None of these has ever been a higher aim than eliminating Hamas to ensure his political survival. Consider all the influential events inside and outside Israel that have transpired since the Hamas attack. Fighting with Iran, regime change in Syria, charges of genocide and other violations of international law, on-again, off-again relations with the U.S., rising anger among hostage families, large anti-government demonstrations almost daily in Israeli cities, pressure from the Israeli far right, and some of his own advisors. Yet Netanyahu has managed to survive. He is both wildly unpopular and seemingly irreplaceable. How has he done it? My best answer is that Netanyahu is a crafty and wily leader who knows how to lie and connive to his advantage. He will insist he wants nothing more than to get the hostages back and stop the fighting. Nothing could be further from the truth. Freeing the hostages and achieving a ceasefire will only happen on his watch when he is convinced that Hamas has been thoroughly destroyed and cannot rise again. That aim is surely unachievable, but it gives Netanyahu the justification for continuing military actions in Gaza and removing all Palestinians either to other countries or to internal mass detention facilities. For leaders like Netanyahu, having an enemy, as Chairman Mao once said, is a good thing. That applies to Hamas and to Iran. It's to his political advantage to have enemies that require a permanent state of war. Conflict with Iran led to a surge in Netanyahu's popularity and the public confidence in the Israeli Defense Forces. National security for Israelis is foremost, and Netanyahu says only he can deliver it. On the other hand, ending the war with Hamas might mean an end to Netanyahu's long-time reign. Hence his support for a comprehensive agreement with Hamas, a temporary ceasefire in exchange for the release of all remaining hostages. He knows that such an agreement has been off the table for many months. Hamas has already agreed to a plan put forward by Egypt and Qatar for a phased ceasefire and hostage release that will lead to a permanent settlement. Netanyahu once backed that plan until Hamas embraced it. The latest example of Netanyahu's war-first policy is the Israeli attack on Hamas headquarters in Doha, Qatar. That's where its negotiators in peace talks that Qatar co-sponsors with Egypt live. The attack failed to kill Hamas's leaders, and Qatar suspended the talks. Multiple sources are reporting that Netanyahu ordered the attack despite resistance from Mossad, the spy agency, and Israeli intelligence. They and most of the defense establishment reportedly were concerned about an attack's impact on peace talks and the hostages. But that argument, far from deterring Netanyahu, must have emboldened him to go ahead. Netanyahu is feeding the ambitions of his far-right supporters, without whom his rule cannot continue. They have always wanted to turn occupied land into Israeli land, and they're on the verge of accomplishing that. Israel's finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, who oversees the West Bank, has distributed a map that shows 82% of what Israel calls Judea and Samaria being taken over by Israel. The map carries the logo of Israel's defense ministry. There's little doubt that Netanyahu supports this move. Charges of ethnic cleansing will no more deter Netanyahu in this annexation than they have in the occupation of the Gaza Strip. Netanyahu has the full support of the Trump administration, which essentially has outsourced policy to Israel. Trump claims that, quote, the Israelis have accepted my terms. It is time for Hamas to accept as well. Actually, his terms are Netanyahu's. Release all the hostages, implement a 60-day ceasefire, form a new government with Hamas excluded and disarmed, and end the war. Even an Israeli analyst considered to be close to Netanyahu acknowledged, quote, this is not an American proposal, but an Israeli one, wrapped in elegant cellophane and labeled made in the USA. When Israel attacked the Hamas headquarters in Qatar, Netanyahu insisted it was a, quote, wholly independent Israeli operation. So much for Trump's peace plan. What we are witnessing is a mirror image of Trump's defeatist Ukraine policy, in which the pretense of upset with Putin masks a willingness to forgive his every insult and every act to undermine prospects for peace. Putin relentlessly bombs Ukraine, Netanyahu relentlessly bombs Gaza. Both know they have Trump in the palm of their hands. Next week's commentary will explore that theme further. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, John Nelson, and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Brian Bull, Eric Galatas, and Dr. Anthony Lysowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $45,000 by September 20th. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We'll be hearing about an upcoming exhibit at the Multnomah Art Center on the Portland Zine Symposium.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm John Nelson. I'm speaking with the Multnomah Arts Center's Michael Walsh and Megan Hatch about their upcoming show with Portland Zine Symposium. So we got a chance to talk with the symposium's B.B. Anderson as well. The Portland Zine Symposium has been putting on events in Portland now for as long as I've been here, over a decade, and I've come to look forward to meeting new authors and artists at their yearly event. The symposium this year will take place November 8 and 9 at Portland State University Smith Ballroom at PSU, where attendees can count